This edition of The Wellness Prescription is brought to you by Healthy Planet, making the world healthier and greener one day at a time.
Welcome to The Wellness Prescription on 105.9 The Region. I'm Dr. Claudia. Thank you for joining me today. My guest is pediatric ER doctor, Dr. Natasha Kolia, otherwise known as Dr. Tash, which I absolutely love because I'm sure the kids love to have a cool doctor with a cool name. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Claudia. It's always a pleasure and I'm very happy. It's been a while since I've been on the radio.
I always enjoy chatting with you about what is happening in the ER at SickKids and what have you been seeing predominantly showing up these days at a crazy busy time of the year where everybody seems to be battling some sort of cold or flu virus.
What comes into the ER is very affected, not just about seasons and we notice that certain things happen during certain times of the year. But we also know it's also affected by what is being spoken about, you know, in the media and totally understandable. So we are still in that winter season about to hit spring. So what is very common around this time of year are definitely viral infections, fevers. I think this is probably predominantly what we see all year round, runny nose, cough. But the big things that we're seeing now or what parents are most commonly concerned about coming into the ER is, you know, strep throat. As you've probably heard it. A lot of it on the radio, you know, is it really on the rise? Is it not on the rise? What do we have to be worried about? But I feel like we've seen strep throat a lot before. You know, why now? Why now more of a concern overall? And then the typical injuries. You know, it is wintertime still. People are out there having fun and that will never change.
I feel that what parents fear the most is what happens if strep throat goes untreated. Are there serious side effects? Are there other conditions that can develop from it?
I personally don't have our statistics, you know, in the emergency department. Have we seen overall a rise? I know this because we were looking at, a few weeks ago, the numbers in general from like a CDC standpoint and even Health Canada. Have we seen more people being diagnosed with strep throat? Yes. And the question becomes, is it because people are presenting more and getting tested for that, and that's why we're seeing the numbers? Or is it actually because, you know, we are actually having more, you know, more disease of strep throat? And that predominantly we think is because we know bacterial infections do happen either during a viral infection or after a viral infection. And we also know that strep throat is very, very common when you put a lot of people in close proximity of each other, right? It's a respiratory droplet, so sneezing, coughing, and now kids are back at school. So you've got this period of COVID-19 where we all kind of isolated away from each other. We saw very little episodes because I don't think we were in the environment of it. And then now we are having what appears to be more episodes, but everyone's back at school. There are more people around each other. There's people traveling a lot more, which is close in a airplane or at resorts or wherever you're staying. And so I will have to tell parents, you know, the same thing is that we may be seeing a small percentage increase, but why? I think it's multifactorial as we're looking at it, but is it still more commonly in kids? Yes. You know, ages 5 to 11 is the most common age, but we're starting to see it even a little younger than that. But I think the question that parents are asking is more about the more concerning things about strep throat.
Is there a chance that strep throat will clear on its own?
Strep throat in anyone under the age of 2 is very, very uncommon. The Canadian Pediatric Society usually even recommends that there's no testing under 2 unless you know that there is a local outbreak or that child under the age of 2. They actually say 2 to 3. 3 is kind of the upper echelon of that. What I think most parents don't know is that strep and the other one is staph. These are 2 bacteria. They're not viruses. They live everywhere, in our nose, in our mouth. They like orifices on our skin. So at baseline, we have this bacteria. The question is what makes it proliferate to a point that we actually need treatment. So a certain age, you have it there. There's a lot of it in abundance. And sometimes that virus can trigger that increased number of it. And you're right. The symptoms are, so first is recognizing the symptoms. One, you know, let's say there is an outbreak in daycare. That makes sense that now that you're going to go see a doctor. Symptoms vary. So first of all, you have to have a fever. I've never seen strep throat without a fever. So if there's no fever and a sore throat, unlikely that it's going to be strep throat. That's first. 2, it's sore throat, maybe refusing to eat, depending how old they are, and they can't tell you that they have a sore throat. Inflamed tonsils, it's not like a textbook where it has to have white pustules. You can just have red inflamed tonsils. Sore neck, stiff neck, which is why a lot of parents come running in because they're like, oh my gosh, stiff neck must be meningitis. Not necessarily. Some kids will develop a rash, which is scarlet fever, which is also, again, from group A strep, swollen lymph nodes. And then typically, I've seen maybe 50% of the time abdominal pain, like right at the umbilicus or in the right lower quadrant. So then parents come running in thinking their child has appendicitis. But what I will say is that more often than not, you can't really have cough, runny nose, congestion, and all the other viral symptoms. But because of what we're seeing so much like coinciding, we've sort of used the clinical judgment aspect of it. So if we really have a high suspicion, we know with everything going on, we're going to test. And this is what I'm going to tell all families. If you have those symptoms and you're concerned, you don't need to come to the ER if your child is drinking and looking generally fairly well. Because if you do have strep throat, you have up to 9 to 10 days to treat before there's a concern for complications that we know of. One being rheumatic fever, which over time has been eradicated because usually we treat very quickly. Two is a thing called glomerulonephritis, which is just an inflammation and irritation and sometimes a dysfunction of the kidneys. And then there's the big one that looms over everyone's head, which is the invasive group A strep, which has been in the news a lot. And so I tell parents, if you have a concern, you don't necessarily need to come to the ER to be told you have strep throat. I would never, ever recommend a parent to allow their child to be treated without actually being tested. Because again, if you treat with antibiotics blindly, without knowing for sure with a rapid test, either rapid or a culture, you don't really know for sure if it was strep throat. So now you're just blindly telling parents, here's some antibiotics. And then what if the patient still has fever? It's likely a virus. Now we just gave unnecessary antibiotics. And that's how antibiotic resistance obviously develops over time. And again, antibiotics cause diarrhea sometimes. You don't want those kind of things and having to force a child to take antibiotics if they don't need it. So my recommendation is symptoms, concern, don't run to the ER unless you're really unwell. Get tested first. Wait for that test result. You have 9 to 10 days to treat, likely up to 9 to 10 days to start treatment.
I want to go back to the lower right quadrant pain. We all know that most of us assume that that is going to be associated with the appendix. And this is a symptom of strep throat that I was not even aware of. So I appreciate that you brought that up. But what is the cause of that?
Yeah. And I don't think it's consistent across the board. But I will say, you know, you get kids who come in and have these symptoms, and the minute anyone in the community hears right lower quadrant pain, maybe doesn't explore the neck, doesn't explore anywhere else, thinks appendicitis. And I think what I've read most of the time in the literature is that we have lots of lymph nodes, especially in the lower quadrants. We have lymph nodes everywhere, our axilla, our neck, and we know with strep throat, we can get some lymph node inflammation. But there's particularly just some lymph nodes that are in the lower gut area that just inflame and get irritated. And we have to be able as physicians to take a step back and say, oh, they have a fever, they're not feeling well, they're achy, they have a sore throat, or if they're too young to say that, they're vomiting or refusing to eat. And they have lower right quadrant pain. But if I go do an exam, their belly is totally tender. Their belly is totally fine. Sure, I'll consider that, but what else can mimic that? And I think it's not 100%. You know, it doesn't always work that way, but it is something to be aware of.
I'm so happy that you mentioned that we don't need to run to the ER. I wish that I knew this when my kids were little, that we could just wait a few days, see if the symptoms persist, see if the fever breaks, and, you know, taking our time before we're prescribing unnecessary antibiotics. I believe the key is understanding the difference between a bacterial infection and a viral infection, which then leads me to my next question. Let's discuss booger. Is the color of our booger determining what kind of virus we are dealing with?
Booger will change the longer it's in your nose. So the color, the thickness, there is, you know, it makes logical sense if you understand kind of the pathophysiology. So with viruses, most times you get the super runny nose, they continue to just keep going. It's usually very clear. And then what you notice happens is that as the virus improves, or as you start to work it out of your system, I'll say to parents, well, how's the runny nose? Oh, it's improving, but now it's thicker. Okay. But we don't have the fever so much anymore. And I'm like, because you're reducing the amount of flow, because as the virus is working in the system, that the virus is not causing inflammation in here, not causing all that mucus. And now it's starting to become thicker because it's not running out of the nose anymore. Now it's spending time in the nostrils. And as we know, the nose works as kind of a filter before you breathe in, right? And so what it does, it's catching all the particles and it's sitting in there and spending time in there. Now it's becoming thicker. It's becoming gross. It's becoming crusty. It's becoming all of that. One of the big things that most, I guess, pediatricians and physicians will say, though, is if you're in the context of fever and you're at about 10 days of fever, this is either you starts with a virus or doesn't, and now your child has severe facial pain or like jaw pain or nose pain or head pain when you palpate, then there's that consideration of a sinus infection. And that's where people most likely will say, yeah, that's when I see that really thick, dark, you know, darker color, yellowy, greeny color mucus coming from the nose. That's absolutely true, because in sinus infections, that is sitting in your sinuses. It's not coming out. So if you think about the logic behind mucus sitting in a spot for a long time, it filters all the junk coming in, of course it's going to change color. But this is where it also requires you to understand that kids at the age of 2 don't really have sinuses. They're like little holes, right? So to be at a point of a sinus infection, I mean, that little hole there full of mucus shouldn't cause this rip-roaring amount of pain. So it requires us as pediatricians to dive a little further, even just not family doctors, any physician who sees a child, and not start throwing antibiotics at a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old whose sinuses are still not fully developed, and start saying that's a sinus infection at day 3, because there's so many more other things that it most likely is going to be than a sinus infection.
Well, now that we all understand booger, and we know that is really nothing to worry about, and it really doesn't determine what we're, you know, what kind of an illness our child is bringing home, I feel so much better. When we come back, more with Dr. Tash and a discussion on why measles is coming back. This is the Wellness Prescription on 105.9 The Region. Stay with us.
Connect with us on Twitter at 105.9 The Region or call 416-335-1059 or email info@1059theregion.com. This is 105.9 The Region. This edition of The Wellness Prescription is brought to you by Healthy Planet, making the world healthier and greener one day at a time.
You're listening to 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to The Wellness Prescription. Before the break, Dr. Tash and I were discussing strep throat and how we don't need to run to the ER with the first sign of a sore throat and a fever. We can wait it out a little bit. So thank you so much for clarifying that. But what I'm finding is that there is in the news, there is a, you know, big talk on some of the things that have come back and are making a resurgence. And one of the things that I'm finding is that measles is on the rise. What would be the cause of us contracting measles once again?
When we're talking about it, looking at 2020 to 2022, what we've seen based on these two factors is that we've seen a accumulation of unprotected individuals, often in like little pockets. We're now seeing outbreaks. And this is what we know this is a vaccine preventable disease. Like the vaccine came out in the 1960s. And so CDC, I think, predicted over 61 million doses of measles containing vaccine were postponed or missed in those 2-year periods. Then when they looked at 2 days ago, they looked at measles cases, jumped by 79% around the world. And that is threatening to the reverse of how much we improved by 73% in measles, just cases, between 2000 and 2018. Now, to put in perspective for people, for us to reach herd immunity, think about that, 2000 to 2018, we reduced measles outbreak by 73%. That took 18 years. For herd immunity, that means that majority of people are protected. About 75%, I think, or more of a population needs to be vaccinated. But most countries around the world have now been below that threshold in the last 3 years. And the age in which we get measles vaccine, which is a 2-part vaccine, is first at 1 year and then at 4 to 6 years. So we are at a really tough stage. So when people ask us, you know, first of all, measles is not a new virus. But when we look at how long it took us to get to a point where we're protecting the youngest that are not vaccinated, the most immunocompromised, who some cannot actually get the vaccine. And now we're seeing this increase and how quickly we can that can be reversed because of these two factors. It is our job now to kind of step back and go, we know that this, there's science that supports the safety and effectiveness of the vaccines. We know there's a lot of distrust in vaccines, and that is unfortunately a shame for us as who are protecting. We're trying to protect people. We're not trying to harm people. But if these vaccinations rates continue to decline, my concern is that we'll see more and more of the disease that we were just hoping at some point to completely eliminate. And where can we step in and where can we now become voices of trust, not mistrust? And how do we reach those people to show them, or even how do we get all these people in to get these vaccinations, right? Because you can't really speed up the time in between the two. Right? You still need to wait a certain period of time between the two vaccines. And we know one vaccine provides 93%, not complete immunity. It's to severe illness if your child gets it. And two is 97%. So how do we do that? And it's really scary to know that, you know, what was it, just a few weeks ago, Mississauga had its first case. But we remind parents, and I think this is where I'm glad we're having this conversation, is if your child is within that age range and they don't have the vaccine and there's high suspicion that your child potentially was in contact with someone with measles, or you are concerned that this child might have measles, please don't come running to the emergency department. And the reason why I say that is if you run into the emergency department, and now you're sitting in the emergency department, every minute in that emergency department that your child is breathing around people, everyone in that place is now an exposure. So you got to be very, very careful and make sure you work with the right people and make the right phone calls. You know, public health is the biggest one you should be potentially being in contact with other than your physician. Because then now every person that was sitting in that emergency department, I think for at least it's like a 5-6 hour period. I could be wrong, but there is a time frame from when you are sitting in that ER with your child that every person has to be contacted and be made aware, because that's how quickly it spreads. It's not just a, you know, I have to sit there with you for 2 hours. It is a very highly contagious virus. So there's a lot of factors to it. I just hope that we find our way back.
Well, my daughter was one of those kids that because of COVID maybe had to catch up. And it's awesome because I got a letter from public health saying that, you know, she needs to be updated. And, you know, they're offering clinics at the school, clinics at public health. So I think it's a great way for all of us to catch up. But what happens if you miss a measles vaccine?
So I'm going to preemptively say I'm not an immunologist. I will say that, but I am a pediatrician who, you know, does deal with vaccines, and we deal with vaccine safety, and we deal with, you know, how strong vaccines are. We know that one vaccine, regardless, if you never get the second one, is still a 93% coverage. We'll use the word coverage because I can't assume everyone understands all the lingo when it comes to immunity. And we hope that by the time that there's no waxing or waning, I don't know for sure, and I cannot say for sure, that there's no waxing and waning of that first vaccine up until that age, right? The reason why it's specifically that age range is because they know it helps to build the immunity. So it's a great question. I personally cannot say for sure. I would like to think that if we're setting it 4 to 6, it's because we know that that's probably the longest time in between the two vaccines that we can give for the most optimal effect. But we know that at least one does give some decent level of immunity.
So another question that I have is if you have a teenager who has been vaccinated, they are not the demographic that we are worried about. They are still protected. We are more concerned with the younger kids who maybe haven't been vaccinated and will be exposed. Those are the kids who will maybe carry it and spread to the younger ones.
There it is. right? So you can still come in contact with the virus, as we know, and you can still potentially carry it without symptoms, without even severe. Like, we know this, right? This is how vaccines work, right? Vaccines work as I'm introducing a highly contagious virus to my child, or as you know, over the years, pneumococcal, even for older, you know, patients as they get them, in a small quantity so that the body can be exposed without danger. And the immune system, which is completely complex, goes, ooh, I recognize this. I'm going to learn how to build an army against it so that if I ever come in contact with the real thing in its full form, I know how to fight it quicker. I have some sort of defense line, and I will more likely than not develop the most severe symptoms that can come from this. So it's a form of protection. So, but that doesn't mean, as we know, that that doesn't mean that the virus can't still be in us and we just don't have symptoms, just as we knew with COVID, where people got confused. You could have the COVID vaccine, which means you can come in contact with COVID and never have a symptom. And all of a sudden now you're going into someone else's home or someone else's place, and that person is not vaccinated, or that person has an immune system that isn't as strong as yours. And now you give it to them without knowing, not purposeful. I'm not saying it's purposeful. But this is just how viruses work, right? I'm trying to say it as simple as I can to help people understand that. So if I came in contact with measles, would I be concerned that I have measles? Maybe, because again, from a perspective, I do have autoimmune stuff, but I've also, it's been a long time since I've had MMR. And I will tell this to people, I actually, you know, going through fertility, I had to get checked and made sure I had proper levels, you know, of different vaccinations, right? Measles, mumps, rubella. And my immunity for MMR was actually low. So I actually had to repeat the MMR 2 years ago. So I was recently, I hate the word boosted, because you really can't boost an immune system. Like, the immune system is very complex, but I had to receive it again, because you never want to get rubella, measles while you're pregnant. So if there was an off chance that happened and I didn't have that immunity, that would be dangerous to myself and potential fetus. So I want people to realize, like, depending on who you are and your health too, if you're concerned and you don't know if you're fully immune from your previous vaccinations, it is something that you could consider getting looked at.
Well, Dr. Tash, thank you so much for joining me today. I feel like I learned so much, and I'm sure that we helped so many listeners navigate parenting of young kids. If listeners do want to learn more about you and follow you on social media, how can they do that?
It's very easy. I have tried to, because I enjoy being able to converse and also actually respond to people when I can in timely fashion. I've cut back on how much social media I'm out there. So right now I'm Dr. Tash Official on Instagram. And on my Instagram page, I have a Linktree link that actually is all my parent resources that whatever I provide in the ER, I actually have them up there for parents to look at. And I try to update those. I'm no longer on Twitter, and that's totally fine. Facebook is my name. And I am eventually going to change all of this into YouTube videos. So there's plenty of stuff on there. I do a lot of live discussions, and there's a lot on strep throat on there already. And immunity. So if anyone's interested, it's where you can find me.
You can always find me on Instagram at Claudia_Macchiella or my website, ClaudiaMacchiella.com. If you missed any part of our show, go to 1059theregion.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and of course, Audible. I'm Dr. Claudia. Thank you for listening, and I hope this helps you live your best life.
The Wellness Prescription was brought to you by Healthy Planet. Order online at healthyplanetcanada.com or go online to find a location nearest you.